Welcome to Literature Out Loud, sponsored by RMU Radio and by Rune, the Robert Morris University Literary Magazine. I'm John Lawson. My guest today is an old friend, the poet, writer of creative nonfiction, and retired registered nurse, Todd Davis. Welcome, Todd.
Thanks, John.
For many years, Todd Davis produced the Seattle Poetry Slam, and he performed his poetry in slam venues across the country, at the Green Mill in Chicago, the New Eurekan in Manhattan, the Bumbershoot Festival in Seattle, and many other venues. He's published several books, including Sun Plus Moon Rendezvous and Criminal Thoughts, and his work has appeared in a wide variety of places, including Rattle, The Lyric, 14 by 14, Blue Collar Review, and many others. Todd, I usually ask guests to introduce themselves by reading something. Can we kick off with a poem from you?
Sure. Should I introduce it?
Yeah, please.
So a couple of years ago, my partner Sue and I were at our house in Asheville, and I looked out the back window, and there were five robins on the ground. And she's a bird lover, and she was in the other room, and I said, look out your window and hear these early spring robins. I went back to my computer, and 5 minutes later, she said, look out there now. And there was a hawk. All the robins were gone except for one, and it was under the talons of a hawk on the ground. And the hawk was getting ready to eat it. It took about 30 minutes. First, he stood on the prey a long time and looked around to make sure there was nobody interfering, and then he began to pluck all the feathers off, and there was this plume of feathers that went up in the air and settled around him like a halo. It was really beautiful and terrifying at the same time. And by the time he was done, it was dusk, and the hawk was still there in the half light, sort of looking off. And when he was done, I went outside, and there was nothing but a circle of feathers left. So this is a sonnet. I primarily write Shakespearean sonnets, and this is called Circle of Feathers in a Suburban Backyard. The hawk stood on top of the dying bird. Its talons fierce dug deep into the meat. In final throes, the robin twitched and jerked, but nothing now could save it from its fate. For half an hour, the raptor used its beak to pluck the downy plumage from its prey and strip the quills from wings once strong and sleek while standing on the carcass where it lay. The feathers seemed to have a life their own. They swirled in air and floated round the kill and made a cloud, a plume that once had flown, but settled now on gentle ground so still. And in this circle of feathers, the hawk, majestic, glared into the deepening dusk where nothing will be spared.
Yeah, that Shakespearean final couplet there.
Yeah, I love the sonnets. I started writing them about 20 years ago with the intention of, I knew I could never write them as well as Shakespeare, but I figured I could write more than he did. And so I set myself the goal to write 155. He wrote 154. And I mean, as silly as that is, I'm up to 140. So I'm 70 years old. I figure it's all gravy from here on, but if I get another 10 years, I'll finish the project. But you're right. The thing that really sold me on this ancient form is just the last two lines are like American haiku. They're just beautiful.
So this is an unusual interview for me because I've followed your career since we met as freshmen in 1967.
Right.
But I think the folks might be interested in knowing how you went from this, you know, wild hair slam poet to a writer of sonnets.
It was a couple of things coming together. Part of it was that I was in a rock band, and so I was rhyming stuff, and that sort of transferred over into the poetry at some point. But I didn't know a whole lot about it, so I had to study forms, and that's when I ran across, I had written a few sonnets, but that's when I ran across Shakespearean sonnets, and I started reading about them, and I just loved what they did. You know, when you write free verse, you just write anything you want to. You just sit down, you have an idea, and jot it down, and there's nothing that's really constraining you except your thoughts. But if you write in a form, the form leads you, and you have to go where it leads. So if you're writing a rhyme poem, I mean, this is true for hip-hop or really for anybody that writes in form. In a sonnet, for instance, the first line rhymes with the third, the second with the fourth. So you write the first line, you write the second line, you can write anything you want. But when you get to the third line, all of a sudden it has to rhyme with the first, and you work on this and work on this and then back out and start over because you just can't find something that's appropriate. So when you're done, instead of feeling like you created something, you feel like you discovered something, as if you were pulled through the poem. And you have this immense satisfaction because this is 14 lines. If I wrote a 14-line free verse poem, I could probably be done in an hour or two. But, you know, I worked on this for days, hours to make it, you know, come out right. And so at the end, you kind of sit back and go, wow, you know, what a relief. And then you're just sort of amazed at what's, it doesn't feel like it's yours. Yeah. It feels like it came from somewhere else because of that. So I got addicted to that feeling.
Yeah, real craftsmanship. Why don't you read another?
Okay.
By the way, what was the name of that first one?
Circle of Feathers in a Suburban Backyard. The other thing that that took me about that, and I'm glad you asked about the title, the whole notion of suburban backyard, you know, we live in such sheltered environments. I mean, there is stuff going on in nature around us all the time that we're not even aware of. And so here I am sitting at my computer, and there's a life and death struggle 20 feet away from me in my backyard, if I only take the time to notice it and then ponder, well, what does that mean? I mean, really, we're all involved in a life and death struggle, but we're sort of divorced from nature. So I like the idea of sort of saying, look, there's this stuff going on right around you and in the suburbs that is pretty brutal.
Yep.
Okay, so this next one is called Hold Me. The mountain is moody with clouds today, but we're on the move in its shadow with chores and errands. And yet, no matter how important we think our lives, no matter our tribal affiliations or rank, on the cosmic radar screen, we're just a blip, blinking and chirping and flashing, and then we're gone. Well, the earth will still be here, who knows what shape, but time will stitch the wounds or gouge fresh ones. I watched your face as you came just moments ago, a spark that raged to flame then sputtered to smoke. You rake the hair on my chest with your fingers now. Half on, half off our bed, I swoon on my back. Hold me. Don't let me fall into this abyss. Pull me up and give me one more kiss.
Yeah.
So what I found myself doing, the sonnet lends itself to this sort of the two extremes of poetry. One is the very personal. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at Shakespeare's sonnets and the overwhelming majority are love poems. It also lends itself to broad pronouncements because it's such a short form. You know, you can only put so much imagery in it, and so it lends itself to didacticism, to making a statement about society or the world. And recognizing those two things, one of the things I've tried to do is to combine them in one poem.
Yeah.
So to start out with the big picture and then I end up with a very small, intimate scene that somehow, you know, fits into this.
Yeah. That actually reminds me of the poems of Catullus, which I'm going to teach probably tomorrow, and I'll have to remember to make a note of that. For that. Good. That the imagery there reminds me of the idea of orgasm as the little death.
Yeah.
Well, what's next?
I have a third, if you want me to read it. So, for the sake of anybody who might be listening, you and I have a mutual friend, Ames Arnold. And it's sort of a joke among us that whenever Ames has an unusual dream, he emails it out to all his buddies and tells them what happened. And of course, then we make fun of him and so on. But it's kind of interesting to see what's deep in somebody's consciousness. So once he had a really strange dream. It made no sense, but a little man came up to him and whispered something to him in his ear. And in the dream, Ames wrote it down so he wouldn't forget it. And what he said was, "Innocence is never what it seems." And I just thought, man, I don't even know what that means, but what a great line. And so I emailed him back and said, "Can I use that?" And he said, "Sure, I don't care." So that's the last line of this poem, and it's a little bit of a dense poem. But anyway, it's what happened was one night, as I'm wont to do, I got up in the middle of the night to drink some water. And I went to the sink, and the moonlight, full moon, was coming through the window, and a stainless steel sink was just shining with all this moonlight. So to me, there was moonlight in the sink. And I wrote this poem called "Through My Kitchen Window." Moonlight pours into my darkened house, and instantly it fills my kitchen sink. It sloshes there and waits, I know, to douse my fiery thirst, my midnight urge to drink. And so I quickly take a cup and dip into the lovely bouncing photon light and raise it reverently up to sip and taste the sun despite this blackened night. The thing we love reflects its opposite, and that is why we search in places strange, and that is why the moonlight never quits despite the fact that everything will change. Moonlight feeds the dreams of all who dream, and innocence is never what it seems.
Yeah, that reminds me of the Beatles song title, "Tomorrow Never Knows."
The other thing, it just dawned on me while I was reading that, was that analogous to the notion that sonnets lend themselves to didacticism and to intimacy is the fact that the language of sonnets is the same way. So that the language of many of my sonnets has a formal quality to it, which sort of matches the form. You know, people really don't talk the way I just read that.
Yeah.
But I also try to mix that kind of formal language with the conversational language, or at least when I'm performing it, to make it sound as if I'm just having a conversation.
Yeah.
And it was something, did you ever see the series Deadwood?
Yeah.
So you remember how that language was just incredibly dense and formal and sophisticated, and yet these are cowboys and rustlers and, you know, just the roughest lot of people. And
yeah.
I just thought, wow, that's really kind of cool.
Sometimes Tarantino's films do the same thing.
Uh-huh.
These rough characters speaking subtly in a very poetic and eloquent way. Well, as part of a project then to display the many faces of Todd Davis, let's move on to another genre
okay.
now. I know you've been writing creative nonfiction for quite a while now.
Right.
Want to share something?
Sure. I think, can I just say something about that first?
Yeah, sure,
I think that the reason that happened was because I'm working in this form, and I needed something more expansive. And in fact, the other poems, and I'll read one or two later, but the other types of things that I read are not at all like that. They're not formal. And so the short creative essay seemed appropriate to me, and I've written one book and I'm working on another, but both of them have this, what your niece called rhizomatic quality. A lot of my stuff kind of goes in a lot of different directions like Southern storytelling does.
My niece's name is Sarah Lawson.
There you go. Yeah. Shout out to Sarah.
Yeah.
So this is a piece that is called Wow. As I do most nights, I went to bed about an hour after Sue did. I was trying not to wake her as I quietly opened the door to the bedroom, and a shaft of light fell across the bed where she lay sleeping. Suddenly, Sue threw off her covers and bolted up to a sitting position on the side of the bed. She pointed at the floor in front of the door and shouted, "Watch out for the broken glass!" Startled, I actually looked down and scanned the floor. Had I missed something? I hadn't heard anything break, and the floor was perfectly clear. "I think you're having a dream, honey," I said as reasonably as I could. "I'm not dreaming," she practically yelled. "There's glass all over the floor." Okay, I'll be careful," I said as I made a grandiose gesture pretending to step over broken glass with my bare feet. Safely in the bedroom, I sat beside her on the bed and rubbed her back with one hand. She slowly began to look around the room and appreciate her partial wakefulness. I suggested again, gently, "I think maybe you were dreaming, sweetheart." This time she gave a little laugh and crawled back under the covers. Sue and I have been together for 35 years, and during that time I've witnessed many curious instances like this that I like to call sleep talking. By her voice, you'd think she was wide awake when really she's in the middle of a dream. Another night I undressed outside the bedroom so as not to wake Sue. When I entered the bedroom completely naked, she sat up in her bed slowly and said in a perfectly reasonable voice, "You're not supposed to dress like that when you're picking strawberries." Dreaming or not, she was right, of course. There are very few situations where picking strawberries nude is appropriate. But again, what was eerie was her voice. It wasn't thick or slurry or mumbly. It gave no indication that she was asleep, but the context was bizarre. By now, I was enamored of my sweetheart's tendency to blurt out the details of her dreams while she was still dreaming them. I found it fascinating and endearing because it was so vulnerable and innocent. I was also genuinely curious about the strawberries, and I didn't want the episode to end, so I said, "What do you mean, honey?" Sue replied in that same fully awake, rational-sounding voice, as if I had doubted her pronouncement, "No." "It's true," she patiently explained. "I had a call from one person and a message." Well, that certainly seemed to settle the matter, because apparently the complaints about me cavorting through the strawberry patch buck naked had been earnest and steady. "Okay," I said, "next time I'll be sure to have clothes on when I pick strawberries." This seemed to satisfy her. She lay back down and I crawled into bed. One night I came into the bedroom and Sue, fully asleep, rolled over and started a conversation with me as if we were sitting at the kitchen table. "Okay, you've got 20 minutes. She pronounced with authority. "To do what, sweetheart?" I instantly replied out of amused curiosity. "To build a motorcycle ramp thing on the side of the road." She seemed to stall and fumble for the right words to explain the task before me. "Are you going to help me?" I asked. "Nope, you're on your own now." Sue jauntily refused to take any responsibility for what I might or might not do. There was even a hint of irritation in her voice about my obviously stupid questions. "Well, am I going to have to go off the ramp on a motorcycle when it's done?" I asked, seeking some clarification about where all this was going and what my liability might be. "That's up to you," she asserted. She was clearly noncommittal. I paused a moment. "Well, okay, I'm putting the finishing touches on the ramp right now. Huh? Sue muttered with a question mark in her voice as if she were just starting to realize how ludicrous the scenario was. I guess instead I should be putting the finishing touches on you, I joked. At that rude remark, she hit me on the arm, laughed, and turned over. In just a moment, she drifted away again. One morning, I got up before Sue and came back later to wake her. She had barely roused herself, not at all like her fully awake-seeming persona when she's sound asleep in the middle of the night. This was the opposite. Her eyes were closed, and she was just on this side of the line between dreaming and waking, just awake enough to feel compelled to tell me the dream she had just had. She lit into it without any explanation, but the words were almost slurred. I was touring an alien spaceship museum run by aliens, and there was a slug on a string. I was killing it by accident, she mumbled, clearly upset. And who among us wouldn't be upset about that? Not about the aliens. Everybody knows there are aliens among us. And who better to run the alien spaceship museum, by the way? No. It was accidentally killing the slug that concerned her. Sue is an animal lover, and apparently that includes slugs. And listening to her thinly disguised anguish, it concerned me too. We were watching TV one night, and Sue fell asleep on the couch. The show ended, and I gently tried to wake her to go to bed. She opened her eyes and looked straight at me and said, "Are we going to dry tattoo everybody with the filling, all the people at work?" I didn't really know where to start on this one. For one thing, I had no idea what dry tattooing was, so I said my usual, "What do you mean, honey?" As she fluttered her hands around her face, Sue replied, "Well, it's in my head, but the words won't come out of my mouth right." I took her hand and led her to bed. I know the feeling about the words not coming out of my mouth right. I think we all do, and not just when we're dreaming. But despite any inarticulateness, there's still wisdom in her dream pronouncements and in her images strung together like a surreal poem with its own sagacity and logic and erudition. Once when we were staying in a motel, Sue fell asleep while I watched TV. When I finally turned off the TV and crawled under the covers, she said in her perfectly lucid sleep voice, "That's a definite no on that item." I snuggled in next to her and kissed her on the shoulder and joked, "How about a definite yes on this item?" She just chuckled and turned over. I responded to another waking dream she had in a similar fashion once. I'd crawled into bed when she said to me, again as if wide awake but really sound asleep, "I'm hungry." "Sweetheart," I said, "are you hungry for my sweet lovin'?" She almost shouted back, "No, I'm hungry to kick your ass." Then she laughed out loud and dove deeper into her nocturnal reveries. Like all these incidents, she had no recollection the next day, but she laughed the next day at what she had said and told me I deserved it, which I did. I sometimes feel guilty intruding into her dream life or making light of it, but it's not like she doesn't try to include me by asking me direct questions. One night as I crawled into bed, Sue asked me, "Where are all the other people?" "Well, it's just you and me in bed, honey." I amused myself momentarily by pondering how many other people we might actually be able to squeeze onto our queen mattress. I decided it depended on whether stacking was allowed and how well the people knew each other. "No, but where are all the other people?" she insisted again. In this case, she eventually came fully awake and explained that she thought we were on a plane. An image popped into my head of our mattress sailing through the sky full of people screaming and hanging on, pillows hitting the ground from 35,000 feet. I wondered if a pillow hit someone from that height, whether it would kill them. Probably. Then I pondered the difficult job the headline writer would have trying to explain such a thing. The dreams of my sweetheart take my mind to places I wouldn't go on my own. In the black of the night once, I barely came awake, just enough to be aware that I was fumbling around with Sue's hand, trying to lock fingers and hold hands with her while we were both asleep. As my fingers intertwined with hers, she laughed out loud in her sleep as if she were delighted that we were holding hands. Then both of us silently disappeared back into our separate and unknown dreams. Another time I'd just gotten into bed and was still fully awake when I saw her hand was lying outside the cover. I gently took her hand in mine with the intention of drifting off to sleep while holding hands with her. But as I gingerly picked up her hand, she suddenly grabbed mine tightly, and though she was still fully asleep, she heartily shook it up and down and said, "Hey, good to see you," in a jovial voice. Then she pulled her hand away, gave a little laugh of satisfaction, turned over, and vanished beneath the surface again. She knew nothing of this the next day. Obviously, she's capable of actually joking while she dreams, which I guess explains the number of times I wake up to hear her laughing in her sleep. A few nights ago, I got up to pee. I crawled back into bed and settled down, trying to drift back off to sleep. Suddenly, out of nowhere, but clearly out of somewhere, Sue said in her normal speaking voice, "Wow." By the intonation, I knew that whatever she had just seen in her dream was enchanting. I was fascinated by this, so I tried to find out more. "What is it, sweetheart?" I whispered to her ear. "What did you see?" Sadly, her reply was mumbled, and her words, whatever they were, trailed off into the darkness like smoke. Of all her crazy wisdom dreams, this is the one that I'm most curious about, probably because she offered no specifics and I could get nothing else out of her, no surreal image to prick my imagination, just her exclamation of awed wonderment that I was so jealous to share. What did she see? I wish I knew. I wish she knew, at least consciously knew. Like all her half-awake dreams, she didn't remember anything the next morning. But I can't seem to forget the way she said the word, "Wow." It was like she had witnessed a revelation. I was happy for her. It wasn't broken glass. It wasn't a transgression in the strawberry patch. It wasn't a work dream where she had to dry tattoo everybody. It was, inexplicably, wow. It's been a cold December, and we had a foot of snow last week. Today was sunny and warmer, so tonight is not as bitter, a bit balmier. We took our drinks onto the front stoop to look at the clear night sky and watch the fireworks some unknown neighbor was shooting off. Sue remarked that someone had bought some serious fireworks for New Year's Eve, but in their excitement couldn't wait. As we watched the explosions in the sky and the cascading sparks, she told me about her dream last night. She doesn't often remember them, so this one seems special. In the dream, we were in our own house, which is one story, but we discovered there was an upstairs attic we had been unaware of. It had all these rooms we had never discovered, and the rooms were full of new furniture, like a whole new house, a whole new life hidden from view until now. We wandered through the rooms together, amazed. End of dream. Back on the stoop, I remarked that often an upstairs in a dream represents a person's consciousness, especially their higher consciousness or spirituality. Sue said she knew that. Like in a dream, I took her hand, and we turned back together to look in awe at the streams of sparkling light trailing above us across the black sky. Isn't that what everybody wants? What everybody craves? New dreams in our lives? New rooms to explore? Light sparkling in the darkness, filling us with wonder. New consciousness that transcends this weary old world we're forced to wake up to every morning. Wow.
That was my guest, Todd Davis, reading Wow. You're listening to Literature Out Loud on RMU Radio. Well, let's move into Todd's contemporary writing.
All right, let's go there.
What have you been doing lately?
Well, I think I mentioned that sort of as an antidote to the sonnets, I tend to write stuff that's, I've been writing the creative nonfiction, but then as far as poetry, I started writing these things that are almost like little meditations, and they came out like prose poetry. I don't know what else to call them, and I just have a few of them, but it's sort of, I can tell there's going to be more. And I have a couple of those I could read you.
Good.
This is called the first law of thermodynamics, which is neither matter nor energy can be created or destroyed. And it's just one long run-on sentence. The Buddhists believe that we keep coming back trying to get this living thing right, which they call samsara, a state of death and rebirth that supposedly we're all stuck in until we do get it right and achieve what they call nirvana. But I don't know what to call where I am right now, whether samsara, nirvana, or somewhere sublime in between. As two squirrels chase each other in dense leaves of a late July oak tree, leaving a turbulent trail snaking through the canopy of green, all foreground against a canvas of cobalt and white sky, this strange, wondrous world framed by my office window, through which I watch, leading my life or being led, or somewhere sublime in between, sitting quietly now, revisiting the memory of my birth, thanks to a jolting dose of LSD many decades ago, remembering the walls of my mother forcing me sensate with their violent pressure, sliding down a tube slick with the smell of her blood into the cradling arms of brilliant light and strange babbling robed creatures with no faces, into a confusion of tongues I fell, with no words of my own to describe the rich confection of sensation, this sudden enworldment, capable of no useful sound except the indispensable blast of a spontaneous scream from tiny gasping lungs. Now, a lifetime later, I ponder the firefly I saw through this window last night, blinking against the darkness of the giant oak, as if to say, I never was. Now I'm here. Now I'm gone again. Forever. Over and over. A brief flashing light, escaping nothingness, like me, like all of us, trying hard to revise our past, to peer clearly into the baffling blankness of our future, bewildered and flummoxed, but hoping to take with us the exquisite realness of this now, living our lives as if they mattered, waiting to find out.
The first law of thermodynamics by Todd Davis.
You get old, you start thinking about that stuff, you know, and the whole notion that we were talking about this last night, that from, at least from my perspective, from the Big Bang until April 3rd, 1949, I had no consciousness. I was nothing. I was just, you know, some kind of stardust. And then I lead a life, and at the end of it, I go into eternity and nothingness again. So there's this brief flicker of light in between these two vast darknesses, and that's what the firefly sort of engendered in me. It's on and off and on and off.
Yeah, we were talking about that actually in terms of blinking out for surgery and how it seems instantaneous then that somebody's saying, you're in recovery, Mr. Davis.
Mr. Davis, wake up.
Seems like eternity must be like that.
Yeah.
Well, it's been fun. Let's finish with a piece.
Okay.
Of your choice.
All right. Oh. Okay, so that said, I'll read something that I didn't plan to read. My grandmother's brother, my great uncle, was adopted. And the story of his adoption was passed down through the family. These were incredibly poor people. My great grandfather was a circuit rider, preached at a different church all the time. This is in East Tennessee. I have a picture of that whole family on a porch of a little, you can't even call it a cabin, it's like almost like a shack. And They're very proud people, but they didn't have a whole lot. And he also, my great-grandfather, worked as a coal miner from time to time. He went to preach a funeral for a coal miner's wife who had died in childbirth. And the coal miner couldn't raise this baby and gave it to the preacher, gave it to my great-grandfather, and he took it home. And then this is the story of my Uncle Lawrence. And it's written with a kind of dialect as if it's being told by one of those family members. The coal miner's newborn. Hit was a cruel, raw wind what blew out of them great smoky mountains that bitter November and down across that East Tennessee churchyard grave. The coal miner stood in the drizzling rain among a small knot of neighbors as he watched his 15-year-old wife being lowered into fresh, broke ground, while his newborn son, as yet unnamed, cried in them strong, useless arms of his daddy, cried for milk and for a dead mama he'd never know. When the preacher was done praying and the dirt was done thudding against that homemade pine box and the hot tears of the miner had streaked his face with rivulets of coal dust, the miner held his newborn up to the man of God and he said, "Preacher, you got to take my boy. I'm just a poor coal miner. I can't take him no good care of him. And I ain't got me no woman no more." The year was 1896. And my great-granddaddy, Reverend Benjamin Leach Peters, a circuit-riding Baptist preacher and a coal miner himself, stood in the rain of Roane County, Tennessee, with his long arms open as the miner gently and awkwardly passed him the baby. Benjamin Leach Peters, known as Pappy Dad to his five kids, climbed up on the buckboard with that baby, and holding the reins in one hand and that little baby in the other, he clucked his tongue at the mule and rode over that foggy mountain towards home. When my great-grandma Amanda, known to the family as Buh, when she seen Pappy Dad a-coming down that dirt lane, sitting real awkward on that buckboard, one hand driving that old mule and the other cradled across his chest, she strained to see what he's a-carrying under his coat, trying to keep it dry. Pappy Dad grumbled, "Whoa," to the mule. And when the wagon stopped, he moved slowly and stiffly to dismount, and Buh suddenly knew that what he had, from the tender taut posture that some men have when they hold a newborn baby, like they's a-carrying a pot of scalding water. Under her breath, Buh spoke in a low whisper, "Lord, help us," thinking no one but God would hear. But her 13-year-old daughter, Sadie, my grandma, she heard her. And she heard her mama say to Pappy Dad, "Benjamin, we can't take him. We already got us five kids, and Henry, he's still at the breast. I just ain't got the milk for two. Now, I'll keep this baby the night, but you got to take him down to the county home come daybreak. Promise me you will." That night, the wind rattled that old two-room cabin, and the rain played a drowsy rhythm on the roof, and the fire in the fireplace sputtered from downdrafts. And Pappy Dad got up twice to feed the fire. And Buh, she fed Henry on her left breast and the newborn on her right, on account there was always a little more milk on the right. And Lord knows that child needed it. They all hunkered down under the quilts that night, the whole Peters family. And the older kids nestled and nuzzled in one big straw mattress bed. And Buh, she snuggled that newborn in their bed all night long, just smelling its sweet skin and hair and warming its face with her breath, a cooing and a cuddling and whispering and loving, because every time it thundered, that baby cried. Next morning, the rain had stopped. The land looked new under that slant morning sun. Pappy Dad got up, milked the cow, picked up eggs, fed the chickens and the mule, and he hooked the mule to the buckboard. And my great-grandma, Amanda Peters, Buh, she come to the door, the miner's newborn in her arms, and she stood a minute watching her husband. And then she said, "Where are you fixing to go, Ben?" My great-granddaddy, Benjamin Leach Peters, Pappy Dad, he replied to his wife, "I'm fixing to take that miner's boy down to the county home in Harriman like you told me, I reckon." My grandma Sadie, all of 13 years old, standing there at the door at her mama's side, She heard her mama say something that day that Sadie won't never forget her whole life. 70 years later, my grandma Sadie would still roll a tear when she'd tell the story of that day and get to the part where her mama replied to her husband, Pappy Dad. It was 1896, and Amanda Peters, Buh, she paused a second in that doorway, and she looked down at that sweet baby asleep and so content in her arms. She took a deep breath and sighed it out. And she looked up at her husband, and she gave a little shake of her head like Sadie had seen her do when her way was set. And then Buh fairly shouted at her husband, "Benjamin, it's too late now. He ain't no miner's boy no more. He's iron." And that's how my great uncle, Lawrence Sylvester, come to be my grandma Sadie's baby brother, come to be the youngest Peters boy, come to be family, come to be loved, come to be saved.
The legend of Buh and Pappy Dad. Yeah, great.
Perfectly true story, too.
The Coal Miner's Newborn by Todd Davis. Well, thanks for navigating all the way from Arizona to see us, Todd.
Yeah.
Thanks to our engineer, Malik Johnson. You've been listening to Literature Out Loud, sponsored by RMU Radio and Rune, the Robert Morris University Literary Magazine. This is John Lawson. Thanks for listening.